She's never seen it. And the way she knows how mountains form, and the way she's certain Father Earth is real and alive, and an enemy. Some truths are simply too great to deny. To her surprise, however, Shaffa says, "Oh, I know the moon is real." Perhaps his pain has faded somewhat. Now his expression has hardened as he gazes at the hazy, intermittent disk of the sun, where it's managed to not quite pierce the clouds near the horizon. "That, I remember."
"You really? Then you believe Steel?"
"I believe you, little one, because Origins know the pull of the moon when it draws near. Awareness of it is as natural to you as assessing shakes. But also, I have seen it." Then his gaze narrows sharply to focus on Nasun. "Why, then, did the Stone-Eater tell you about the moon?" Nasun takes a deep breath and lets out a heavy sigh.
"I really just wanted to live somewhere nice," she says. "Live somewhere with you. I wouldn't have minded working and doing things to be a good comm member. I could have been a lorist, maybe." She feels her jaw tighten. "But I can't do that. Not anywhere. Not without having to hide what I am. I like Orogeny Shaffa, when I don't have to hide it. I don't think having it, being a Raga."
She has to stop and blush and shake off the urge to feel ashamed for saying such a bad word. But the bad word is the right word for now. "I don't think being one makes me bad or strange or evil." She cuts herself off again, yanks her thoughts out of that track, because it leads right back to, "But you have done such evil things." Unconsciously, Nasun bares her teeth and clenches her fists. "It isn't right, Shaffa. It isn't right that people want me to be bad or strange or evil, that they make me be bad." She shakes her head, fumbling for words. "I just want to be ordinary, but I'm not, and everybody, a lot of people, all hate me because I'm not ordinary. You're the only person who doesn't hate me for being what I am. And that's not right."
"No, it isn't."
Shaffa shifts to sit back against his pack, looking weary.
"But you speak as if it's an easy thing to ask people to overcome their fears, little one."
And he does not say it, but suddenly Nasun thinks, "Jija couldn't." Nasun's gorge rises suddenly, sharply enough that she must clap a fist to her mouth for a moment and think hard of Ash and how cold her ears are. There's nothing in her stomach except the handful of dates she just ate. But the feeling is awful anyway. Shaffa, uncharacteristically, does not move to comfort her. He only watches her, expression weary, but otherwise unreadable.
"I know they can't do it."
Yes, speaking helps. Her stomach doesn't settle, but she no longer feels on the brink of dry heaves.
"I know they, the Stills, won't ever stop being afraid. If my father couldn't..."
Queasiness. She jerks her thoughts away from the end of that sentence.
"They'll just go on being scared forever. And we'll just go on living like this forever. And it isn't right. There should be a fix. It isn't right that there's no end to it."
"But do you mean to impose a fix, little one?" Shaffa asks.
It's soft. He's guessed already, she realizes. He knows her so much better than she knows herself. And she loves him for it.
"Or an end?"
She gets to her feet and starts pacing, tight little circles between his pack and hers. It helps the nausea and the jittery rising tension beneath her skin that she cannot name.
"I don't know how to fix it."
But that is not the whole truth.
and Shafa scents lies the way predators scent blood. His eyes narrow.
If you did know how, would you fix it?
And then, in a sudden blaze of memory that Nasun has not permitted herself to see or consider for more than a year, she remembers her last day in Terimo. Coming home, seeing her father standing in the middle of the den breathing hard, wondering what was wrong with him, wondering why he did not quite look like her father in that moment. His eyes too wide, his mouth too loose, his shoulders hunched in a way that seemed painful. And then Nasun remembers looking down. Looking down and staring and staring and thinking, what is that? And staring and thinking, is that a ball? Like the ones that the kids at creche kick around during lunchtime. Except those balls are made of leather, while the thing at her father's feet is a different shade of brown. Brown with purplish mottling all over its surface. Lumpy and leathery and half deflated, but no. It's not a ball. Wait, is that an eye? Maybe, but it's so swollen shut that it looks like a big fat coffee bean. Not a ball at all. Because it's wearing her brother's clothes, including the pants Nasun put on him that morning while Gija was busy trying to get their lunch satchels together for creche. Uche didn't want to wear those pants because he was still a baby and liked to be silly, so Nasun had done the butt dance for him, and he'd laughed so hard, so hard. His laugh was her favorite thing ever, and when the butt dance was over, he'd let her put his pants on as a thank you, which means the unrecognizable deflated ball thing on the floor is Uche. That is Uche. He's Uche. No. Nasun breathes. I wouldn't fix it, not even if I knew how. She has stopped pacing. She has one arm wrapped around her middle. The other hand is a fist crammed against her mouth. She spits out words around it now. She chokes on them as they gush up her throat. She clutches her belly, which is full of such terrible things that she must let them out somehow or be torn apart from within. These things have distorted her voice, made it a shaky growl that randomly spikes into a higher pitch and a louder volume because it's everything she can do not to just start screaming. I wouldn't fix it, Shafa. I wouldn't. I'm sorry. I don't want to fix it. I want to kill everybody that hates me. Her middle is so heavy that she can't stand. Nasun drops into a crouch, then to her knees. She wants to vomit, but instead she spits words onto the ground between her splayed hands. Gone. I want it all gone, Shafa. I want it to burn. I want it burned up and dead and gone. Gone. Nothing left. No more hate and no more killing. Just nothing. Rusting. Nothing. Nothing. Forever. Shafa's hands, hard and strong, pull her up. She flails against him, tries to hit him. It isn't malice or fear. She never wants to hurt him. She just has to let some of what's in her out somehow. Or she will go mad. For the first time, she understands her father. As she screams and kicks and punches and bites and yanks at her clothes and her hair and tries to slam her forehead against his. Quickly, Shafa turns her about and wraps one of his big arms around her, pinning her arms to her side so that she cannot hurt him or herself in the transport of her rage. This is what Gija felt, observes a distant, detached, floating obelisk part of herself. This is what came up inside him when he realized Mama lied, and I lied, and Uche lied. This is what made him push me off the wagon. This is why he came up to Found Moon this morning with a glass knife in his hand. This is the Gija in her, making her thrash and shout and weep. She feels closer than ever to her father in this moment of utter broken rage. Shafa holds her until she's exhausted. Finally, she slumps, shaking and panting and moaning a little, her face all over tears and snot. When it's clear that Nosun will not lash out again, Shafa shifts to sit down cross-legged, pulling Nosun into his lap. She curls against him, the way another child curled against him once, many years before, and many miles away, when he told her to pass a test for him so that she could live. Nasun's test has already been met, though. Even the old Shafa would agree with that assessment. In all her rage, Nasun's orogeny did not twitch once, and she did not reach for the silver at all. "Shh, shh, shh," Shafa soothes. He's been doing this all the while, though now he rubs her back and thumbs away her occasional tears. "Shh, poor thing. How unfair of me. When only this morning..." He sighs. "Shh, my little one. Just rest." Nosun is wrung out and empty of everything but the grief and fury that run in her like fast lahars, grinding everything else away in a churning hot slurry. Grief and fury, and one last precious whole feeling. "You're the only one I love, Shafa." Her voice is raw and weary. "You're the only reason I wouldn't, but I..." He kisses her forehead. "Make the end you need, my Nosun." "I don't want..." She has to swallow. "I want you to be alive." He laughs softly. "Still a child, despite all you've been through." This stings, but his meaning is clear. She cannot have both Shafa alive and the world's hatred dead. She must choose one ending or the other. But then firmly Shafa says again, "Make the end you need." Nosun pulls back so she can look at him. He's smiling again, clear-eyed. "What?" He squeezes her, very gently. "You're my redemption, Nosun. You are all the children I should have loved and protected, even from myself. And if it will bring you peace..." He kisses her forehead. "Then I shall be your guardian till the world burns, my little one." It is a benediction and a balm. The nausea finally releases its hold on Nosun. In Shafa's arms, safe and accepted, she sleeps at last, amid dreams of a world glowing and molten, and in its own way, at peace. "Steel," she calls the next morning. Steel blurs into presence before them, standing in the middle of the road with his arms folded and an expression of faint amusement on his face. "The nearest way to Corpoint is not far, relatively speaking," he says when she has asked him for the knowledge that Shafa lacks. "A month's travel or so, of course." He lets this trail off conspicuously. He has offered to take Nosun and Shafa to the other side of the world himself, which is apparently a thing that Stone Eaters can do. It would save them a great deal of hardship and danger, but they would have to entrust themselves to Steel's care as he transports them in the strange, terrifying manner of his kind through the earth. "No, thank you," Nosun says again. She doesn't ask Shafa for his opinion on this, though he leans against a boulder nearby. She doesn't need to ask him. That Steel's interest is wholly in Nosun is obvious, It would be nothing to him to simply forget to bring Shafa, or lose him along the way to Core Point.
But could you tell us about this place we have to go?
Shafa doesn't remember.
Steele's gray gaze shifts to Shafa. Shafa smiles back, deceptively serene.
Even the silver inside him goes still, just for this moment. Maybe Father Earth doesn't like Steele either.
It's called a station,
Steele explains after a moment.
It's old. You would call it a dead civ ruin, although this one is still intact, nestled within another set of ruins that aren't. A long time ago, people used stations, or rather the vehicles kept within them, to travel long distances far more efficiently than walking. These days, however, only we Stone-Eaters and the Guardians remember that the stations exist.
His smile, which hasn't changed since he appeared, is still and wry. It seems meant for Shafa somehow.
We all pay a price for power, Shafa says. His voice is cool and smooth in that way he gets when he's thinking about doing bad things.
Yes. Steele pauses for just a beat too long. A price must be paid to use this method of transportation as well.
We don't have any money or anything good to barter, Nasun says, troubled.
Fortunately, there are other ways to pay.
Steele abruptly stands at a different angle, his face tilted upward.
Nasun follows this, turning, and sees, oh, the sapphire, which has gotten a little closer overnight. Now it's halfway between them and Jekity.
The station, Steele continues, is from a time before the seasons, the time when the obelisks were built. All the lingering artifacts of that civilization recognize the same power source.
You mean, Nasun inhales, the silver.
Is that what you call it? How poetic.
Nasun shrugs uncomfortably.
I don't know what else to call it.
Oh, how the world has changed.
Nasun frowns, but Steele does not explain this cryptic statement.
Stay on this road until you reach the old man's pucker. Do you know where that is?
Nasun remembers seeing it on maps of the Antarctics a lifetime ago, and giggling at the name. She glances at Shafa, who nods and says,
We can find it.
Then I'll meet you there.
The ruin is at the exact center of the grass forest, within the inner ring. Enter the pucker, just after dawn. Don't dawdle reaching the center. You won't want to still be in the forest after dusk.
Then Steele pauses, shifting into a new position, one that is distinctly thoughtful. His face is turned off to the side, fingers touching his chin.
I thought it would be your mother.
Shafa goes still. Nasun is surprised by the flash of heat, then cold, that moves through her. Slowly, while sifting through this strange complexity of emotion, she says,
What do you mean?
I expected her to be the one to do this, is all.
Steele doesn't shrug, but something in his voice suggests nonchalance.
I threatened her calm, her friends, the people she cares about now. I thought they would turn on her and then this choice would seem more palatable to her.
The people she cares about now.
She's not in Terimo anymore?
No.
She has joined another calm.
And they didn't turn on her.
No, surprisingly. Steele's eyes slide over to meet Nasun's.
She knows where you are now, the gate told her. But she isn't coming. Or at least, not yet.
She wants to see her friends safely settled first.
Nasun sets her jaw. I'm not in Jekity anymore, anyway. and soon she won't have the gate either. So she won't be able to find me again. Steele turns fully to face her, this movement too slow and human smooth to be human, though his astonishment seems genuine. She hates it when he moves slowly. It makes her get goosebumps.
"Nothing lasts forever."
"Indeed," he says.
"What's that mean?"
"Only that I've underestimated you, little Nasun."
Nasun instantly dislikes this term of address. He shifts again to the thoughtful pose, fast this time, to her relief.
"I think I'd better not do so again."
With that, he vanishes. Nasun frowns at Shafa, who shakes his head. They shoulder their packs and head west.
2400. Eastern Equatorials. Check if node network was thin in this area because... Unknown calm. Old local song about a nurse who stopped a sudden eruption and pyroclastic flow by turning it to ice. One of her patients threw himself in front of a crossbow bolt to protect her from the mob. Mob let her go. She vanished. Project notes of Yater, Innovator D-Bars.
Syl Anagist. 4. All energy is the same, through its different states and names. Movement creates heat, which is also light that waves like sound, which tightens or loosens the atomic bonds of crystal, as they hum with strong and weak forces. In mirroring resonance with all of this is magic, the radiant emission of life and death. This is our role, to weave together those disparate energies, to manipulate and mitigate, and through the prism of our awareness, produce a singular force that cannot be denied, to make of cacophony, symphony. The great machine called the Plutonic Engine is the instrument. We are its tuners. And this is the goal. Geo-Arcanity.
Geo-Arcanity seeks to establish an energetic cycle of infinite efficiency.
If we are successful, the world will never know want or strife again. Or so we are told. The conductors explain little beyond what we must know to fulfill our roles. It is enough to know that we, small, unimportant we, will help to set humanity on a new path toward an unimaginably bright future. We may be tools, but we are fine ones, put to a magnificent purpose. It is easy to find pride in that. We are attuned enough to each other that the loss of Tetlewa causes trouble for a time. When we join to form our initializing network, it's imbalanced. Tetlewa was our countertenor, the half-wavelengths of the spectrum. Without him, I am closest, but my natural resonance is a little high. The resulting network is weaker than it should be. Our feeder threads keep trying to reach for Tetlewa's empty middle range. Gewa is able to compensate for the loss, finally. She reaches deeper, resonates more powerfully, and this plugs the gap. We must spend several days reforging all the network's connections to create new harmony. But it isn't difficult to do this, just time-consuming. This isn't the first time we've had to do it. Kalenli joins us in the network only occasionally. This is frustrating, because her voice, deep and powerful and foot-tingling in its sharpness, is perfect. Better than Tetlewa's. Wider-ranging than all of us together. But we are told by the conductors not to get used to her.
"She'll serve during the actual startup of the engine," one of them says when I ask. "But only if she can't manage to teach you how to do what she does. Conductor Galot wants her on standby only come launch day.
This seems sensible, on the surface. When Kalenli is part of us, she takes point. This is simply natural, because her presence is so much greater than ours. Why? Something in the way she is made? Something else. There is a held note.
A perpetual hollow burn at the midpoint of her balanced lines, at their fulcrum, which none of us understand.
A similar burn rests in each of us, but ours is faint and intermittent, occasionally flaring only to quickly fade back to quiescence. Hers blazes steadily, its fuel apparently limitless. Whatever this held note burn is, the conductors have discovered it meshes beautifully with the devouring chaos of the onyx. The onyx is the control cabochon of the whole plutonic engine, and while there are other ways to start up the engine, cruder ways, workarounds involving subnetworks or the moonstone, on launch day, we will absolutely need the onyx's precision and control.
Without it, our chances of successfully initiating Geo-Arcanity diminish greatly.
But none of us, thus far, has had the strength to hold the onyx for more than a few minutes. We observe in awe, however, as Kalenli rides it for a solid hour, then actually seems unfazed when she disengages from it. When we engage the onyx, it punishes us, stripping everything we can spare, and leaving us in a shutdown sleep for hours or days. But not her. Its threads caress rather than rip at her. The onyx likes her. This explanation is irrational, but it occurs to all of us, so that's how we begin to think of it. Now she must teach us to be more likable to the onyx in her stead. When we are done rebalancing, and they let us up from the wire chairs that maintain our bodies while our minds are engaged, and we stagger and must lean on the conductors to make it back to our individual quarters. When all of this is done, she comes to visit us. Individually. So the conductors won't suspect anything. In face-to-face meetings, speaking audible nonsense, and meanwhile, Earth-speaking sense, to all of us at once. She feels sharper than the rest of us, she explains, because she is more experienced. Because she's lived outside of the complex of buildings that surround the local fragment, and which has comprised the entirety of our world since we were decanted. She has visited more nodes of Syl Anagist than just the one we live in. She has seen and touched more of the fragments than just our local amethyst. She has even been to Zero Site, where the moonstone rests. We are in awe of this.
I have context, she says to us.
To me, rather. She's sitting on my couch. I'm sprawled face down on the window seat, face turned away from her.
When you do, too, you will be just as sharp.
It is a kind of pigeon between us, using the earth to add meaning to audible words. Her words are simply, I'm older, while a whitter of subsidence adds the nuancing deformation of time. She is metamorphic, having transformed to bear unbearable pressure. To make this telling simpler, I will translate it all as words, except where I cannot. It would be good if we were as sharp as you now, I reply wearily. I am not whining. Rebalancing days are always hard. Give us this context, then, so the onyx will listen, and my head can stop hurting. Kalenli sighs.
There's nothing within these walls on which you can sharpen yourself.
crumble of resentment, ground up and quickly scattered. They have kept you so safe and sheltered. But I think there's a way I can help you and the others do that, if I can get you out of this place.
Help me sharpen myself?
She soothes me with a polishing stroke. It is not a kindness that you are kept so dull. You need to understand more about yourself, what you are.
I don't understand why she thinks I don't understand. I'm a tool, she says.
If you are a tool, shouldn't you be honed as fine as possible?
Her voice is serene, and yet a pent, angry jitter of the entire ambient. Air molecules shivering, strata beneath us compressing, a dissonant grinding whine at the limit of our ability to assess, tells me that Kalinli hates what I have just said. I turn my head to her, and find myself fascinated by the way this dichotomy fails to show in her face. It's another way she's like us. We have long since learned not to show pain or fear or sorrow in any space above ground or below the sky. The conductors tell us we are built to be like statues, cold, immovable, silent. We aren't certain why they believe we actually are this way. After all, we are as warm to the touch as they. We feel emotion as they seem to, although we do seem less inclined to display it in face or body language. Perhaps this is because we have Earth talk, which they don't seem to notice. This is good. In the Earth, we may be ourselves. It has never been clear to us whether we were built wrong or whether their understanding of us is wrong, or whether either matters. Kalinli is outwardly calm, while she burns inside. I watch her for so long that abruptly she comes back to herself and catches me. She smiles. I think you will like me. I consider the possible implications of this. Not that way, I say, out of habit. I have had to explain this to junior conductors or other staff on occasion. We are made like statues in this way as well. A design implementation that worked in this case, leaving us capable of rotting but disinterested in the attempt and infertile should we bother. Is Kalinli the same? No, the conductors said she was made different in only one way. She has our powerful, complex, flexible sesopine, which no other people in the world possess. Otherwise, she's like them. How fortunate that I wasn't talking about sex. There's a drawling hum of amusement from her. It both bothers and pleases me. I don't know why. Oblivious to my sudden confusion, Kalinli gets to her feet. I'll be back, she says, and leaves. She doesn't return for several days. She remains a detached part of our last network, though. So she's present for our wakings, our meals, our defecations, our inchoate dreams when we sleep, our pride in ourselves and each other. It doesn't feel like watching when she does it, even if she is watching. I cannot speak for the others, but I like having her around. Not all of the others do like Kalinli. Gewa in particular is belligerent about it, and she sends this through our private discussion. She appears just as we lose Tetzliwa, just as the project concludes. We've worked hard to become what we are. Will they praise her for our work when it's done? She's only a standby, I say, trying to be the voice of reason. And what she wants is what we want. We need to cooperate. So she says. That is Remwa, who considers himself smarter than the rest of us. We're all made to be equally intelligent.
Remois is just an ass.
The conductors kept her away until now for a reason. She may be a troublemaker.
That is foolish, I believe, though I don't let myself say it, even in Earth talk.
We are part of the great machine.
Anything that improves the machine's function matters. Anything unrelated to this purpose does not. If Kalenli were a troublemaker, Galat would have sent her to the briar patch with Tetlewa. This is a thing we all understand. Gewa and Remwa are just being difficult.
If she is some sort of troublemaker, that will show itself with time, I say firmly. That does not end, but at least postpones the argument.
Kalenli returns the next day. The conductors bring us together to explain.
Kalenli has asked to take you on a tuning mission, says the man who comes to deliver the briefing. He's much taller than us, taller even than Kalenli, and slender. He likes to dress in perfectly matched colors and ornate buttons. His hair is long and black. His skin is white, though not so much as ours. His eyes are like ours, however. White within white. White as ice. We've never seen another one of them with eyes like ours.
He is Conductor Galat, head of the project.
I think of Galat as a plutonic fragment, a clear one, diamond white. He is precisely angled and cleanly faceted and beautiful in a unique way. And he is also implacably deadly, if not handled with precision. We don't let ourselves think about the fact that he's the one who killed Tetlewa.
He isn't who you think he is. I want Galat to look like him the way I want you to look like her.
This is the hazard of a flawed memory.
A tuning mission? Gewa says slowly, to show that she doesn't understand.
Kalenli opens her mouth to speak, and then stops,
turning to Galat. Galat smiles genially at this.
Kalenli's performance is what we were hoping for with all of you. And yet you've consistently underperformed, he says. We tense, uncomfortable, hyper-conscious of criticism, though he merely shrugs.
I've consulted with the chief biomagister, and she's insistent that there's no significant difference in your relative abilities. You have the same capability that she has, but you don't demonstrate the same skill. There are any number of alterations we could make to try to resolve the discrepancy, fine-tuning, so to speak, but that's a risk we'd rather not take so close to launch.
We reverberate in one accord for a moment, all of us very glad for this. She said that she was here to teach us context, I venture, very carefully.
Galat nods to me.
She believes the solution is outside experience. Increased exposure to stimuli, challenging your problem-solving cognition, things like that. It's a suggestion that has merit, and the benefit of being minimally invasive. But for the sake of the project, we can't send you all out at once. What if something happened? Instead, we will split you into two groups. Since there's only one of Kalenli, that means half of you will go with her now, and half in a week.
Outside. We're going outside. I'm desperate to be in the first group. But we know better than to show desire before the conductors. Tools should not want to escape their box so obviously. I say, instead, we've been more than sufficiently attuned to one another without this proposed mission. My voice is flat, a statue's.
The simulations show that we are reliably capable of controlling the engine as expected.
And we might as well do 6 groups as 2,
adds Remhua. By this asinine suggestion, do I know his eagerness?
Will each group not have different experiences? As I understand the outside, there's no way to control for consistency of exposure.
If we must take time away from our preparations for this, surely it should be done in a way that minimizes risk.
I think 6 wouldn't be cost-effective or efficient, Kalenli says, while silently signaling approval and amusement for our play-acting. She glances at Galat and shrugs, not bothering to pretend that she is emotionless.
She simply seems bored.
We might as well do 1 group as 2 or 6. We can plan the route, position extra guards along the way, involve the nodal police for surveillance and support.
Honestly, repeated trips would just increase the chance that disaffected citizens might anticipate the route and plan unpleasantness.
We are all intrigued by the possibility of unpleasantness. Kalenli quells our excited tremors.
Conductor Galat winces as she does this.
That one struck home. The potential for significant gains are why you will go.
Conductor Galat says to us.
He's still smiling, but there's an edge to it now. Was the word will ever so slightly emphasized? So minute the perturbations of audible speech. What I take from this is that not only will he let us go, but he has also changed his mind about sending us in multiple groups. Some of this is because Kalenli's suggestion was the most sensible. But the rest is because he's irritated with us for our apparent reluctance. Ah, Remhua wields his annoying nature like a diamond chisel, as usual. Excellent work, I pulse. He returns me a polite thank you waveform. We are to leave that very day. Clothing suitable for travel outdoors is brought to my quarters by junior conductors. I pull on the thicker cloth and shoes carefully, fascinated by the different textures, and then sit quietly while the junior conductor plaits my hair into a single white braid. Is this necessary for outside? I ask. I'm genuinely curious, since the conductors wear their hair in many styles. Some of them I can't emulate, because my hair is poofy and coarse and will not hold a curl or bear straightening. Only we have hair like this. Theirs comes in many textures.
It might help, says the junior. You lot are going to stand out no matter what, but the more normal we can make you seem, the better.
People will know we're part of the engine, I say, straightening just a little in pride. His fingers slow for a moment. I don't think he notices.
That's not exactly... They're more likely to think you're something else. Don't worry, though. We'll send guards along to make sure there's no trouble. They'll be unobtrusive, but there.
Kalenli insists that you can't be made to feel sheltered, even if you are.
They're more likely to think we're something else, I repeat slowly, thoughtfully. His fingers twitch, pulling a few strands harder than necessary. I don't wince or pull away. They're more comfortable thinking of us as statues, and statues aren't supposed to feel pain.
Well, it's a distant possibility, but they have to know you aren't. I mean, it's...
He sighs. Oh, evil death. It's complicated. Don't worry about it. Conductors say this when they've made a mistake. I don't ping the others with it right away, because we minimize communication outside of sanctioned meetings.
People who are not tuners can perceive magic only in rudimentary ways. They use machines and instruments to do what is natural for us. Still, they're always monitoring us in some measure, so we cannot allow them to learn the extent to which we speak to each other and hear them, when they think we cannot. Soon, I'm ready. After conferring with other conductors over the vine, mine decides to brush my face with paint and powder. It's supposed to make me look like them. It actually makes me like someone whose white skin has been painted brown. I must look skeptical when he shows me the mirror. My conductor sighs and complains that he's not an artist. Then he brings me to a place that I've seen only a few times before, within the building that houses me, the downstairs foyer. Here the walls aren't white. The natural green and brown of self-repairing cellulose has been allowed to flourish, unbleached. Someone has seeded the space with vining strawberries that are half in white flower, half in ripening red fruit. It's quite lovely. The six of us stand near the floor pool, waiting for Colin Lee, trying not to notice the other personnel of the building, coming and going and staring at us. Six smaller than average, stocky people with puffy white hair and painted faces, our lips arranged in defensively pleasant smiles. If there are guards, we do not know how to tell them from the gawkers. When Kalenli comes toward us, though, I finally notice guards. Hers move with her, not bothering to be unobtrusive. A tall brown woman and man, who might have been siblings. I realize I have seen them before, trailing her on other occasions that she's come to visit. They hang back as she reaches us.
"Good. You're ready," she says.
Then she grimaces, reaching out to touch Dashua's cheek. Her thumb comes away dusted with face powder.
"Really?"
Dashua looks away, uncomfortable. They have never liked being pushed into any emulation of our creators. Not in clothing, not in gender. Definitely not in this. "It's meant to help," they mutter unhappily, perhaps trying to convince themselves.
"It makes you more conspicuous, and they'll know what you are anyway."
She turns and looks at one of her guards, the woman.
"I'm taking them to clean this dreck off. Want help?"
The woman just looks at her in silence. Kalenli laughs to herself. It sounds genuinely mirth-filled. She herds us into a personal needs alcove. The guards station themselves outside, while she splashes water on our faces from the clean side of the latrine pool and scrubs the paint away with an absorbent cloth. She hums while she does it. Does that mean she's happy? When she takes my arm to wipe the gunk off my face, I search hers to try to understand. Her gaze sharpens when she notices.
"You're a thinker," she says. "I'm not sure what that's supposed to mean."
"We all are," I say. I allow a brief rumble of nuance. "We have to be."
"Exactly.
You think more than you have to." Apparently a bit of brown near my hairline is especially stubborn. She wipes it off, grimaces, wipes it again, sighs, rinses the cloth, and wipes at it again. I continue searching her face.
"Why
do you laugh at their fear?" It's a stupid question. Should have asked it through the earth, not out loud. She stops wiping my face. Remoir glances at me in bland reproach, then goes to the entrance of the alcove. I hear him asking the guard there to please ask a conductor whether we are in danger of sun damage without the protection of the paint. The guard laughs and calls over her companion to relay this question as if it's ridiculous. During a moment of distraction purchased for us by this exchange, Kalinli then resumes scrubbing me.
"Why not laugh at it?" she says.
They would like you better if you didn't laugh.
I signal nuance. Alignment, harmonic enmeshment, compliance, conciliation, mitigation.
If she wants to be liked.
Maybe I don't want to be liked.
She shrugs, turning to rinse the cloth again.
You could be. You're like them.
Not enough.
More than me. This is obvious. She is their kind of beautiful, their kind of normal. If you tried.
She laughs at me, too.
It isn't cruel, I know instinctively. It's pitying. But underneath the laugh, her presence is suddenly as still and pent as pressurized stone in the instant before it becomes something else.
Anger again. Not at me, but triggered by my words nevertheless.
I always seem to make her angry. They're afraid because we exist, she says. There's nothing we did to provoke their fear other than exist. There's nothing we can do to earn their approval except stop existing, so we can either die like they want, or laugh at their cowardice and go on with our lives.
I think at first that I don't understand everything she just told me. But I do, don't I? There were 16 of us once. Now we are but 6.
The others questioned and were decommissioned for it. Obeyed without question and were decommissioned for it. Bargained, gave up, helped, despaired. We have tried everything, done all they asked and more. And yet now there are only 6 of us left.
That means we're better than the others were, I tell myself, scowling. Smarter, more adaptable, more skilled.
This matters, does it not? We are components of the great machine, the pinnacle of selenogistine biomagistry. If some of us had to be removed from the machine because of flaws...
Tetlewa was not flawed,
Remhwa snaps like a slip-strike fault.
I blink and glance at him. He's back in the alcove, waiting over near Bimnihwa and Salehwa. They've all used the fountain to strip off their own paint, while Kalenli worked on me and Gewa and Dashwa. The guards, Remhwa distracted, are just outside, still chuckling to themselves over what he said to them.
He's glaring at me.
When I frown, he repeats, Tetlewa was not flawed. I set my jaw. If Tetlewa was not flawed, then that means he was decommissioned for no reason at all.
Yes.
Remhwa, who rarely looks pleased on a good day, has now curled his lip in disgust at me. I'm so shocked by this that I forget to pretend indifference.
That is precisely her point. It doesn't matter what we do, the problem is them.
It doesn't matter what we do, the problem is them. When I am clean, Kalenli cups my face in her hands.
Do you know the word legacy?
I've heard it and guessed its meaning from context. It's difficult to pull my thoughts back on track after Remhwa's angry rejoinder. He and I have never much liked one another, but... I shake my head and focus on what Kalenli has asked me. A legacy is something obsolete, but which you cannot get rid of entirely. Something no longer wanted, but still needed.
She grimace smiles, first at me and then at Remhwa.
She's heard everything he said to me.
That will do. Remember that word today.
Then she gets to her feet. The 3 of us stare at her. She's not only taller and browner, but she moves more, breathes more, is more. We worship what she is. We fear what she will make of us.
Come,
she says, and we follow her out into the world. 2613. A massive underwater volcano erupted in the Taser Straits between the Antarctic polar waste and the stillness. Celis leader Zenas, previously unknown to be an origin,
apparently quelled the volcano, although she was unable to escape the tsunami that it caused. Skies in the Antarctic darkened for 5 months, but cleared just before a season could be officially declared. In the immediate aftermath of the tsunami, Celis Leader's husband, the calm head at the time of the eruption, deposed by emergency election, attempted to defend their 1-year-old child from a mob of survivors and was killed. Cause disputed. Some witnesses say the mob stoned him. Others say the former calm head was strangled by a guardian. Guardian took the orphaned infant to warrant. Project Notes of Yater Innovator D-Bars. 5. You are remembered. The attack comes, like clockwork, near dawn. Everyone's ready for it. The camp is about a third of the way into the stone forest, which is as far as Kostrima was able to get before full darkness made further progress treacherous. The group should be able to get all the way through the forest before sunset the next day, assuming everyone lives through the night. Restlessly, you prowl the camp, and you are not the only one to do so. The hunters are supposed to all be sleeping, since during the day they act as scouts, as well as ranging a field to forage and catch game. You see quite a few of them awake, too. The strongbacks are supposed to be sleeping in shifts, but all of them are up, as are a good number of the other castes. You spot Hjorka sitting atop a pile of baggage, her head down and eyes shut. But otherwise, her legs are braced for a quick lunge, and there's a glass knife in each hand. Her fingers haven't loosened with sleep. It's a stupid time to attack, given all this. But there isn't a better one, so apparently your assailants decide to work with what they've got. You're the first to assess it, and you're pivoting on the ball of 1 foot and shouting a warning even as you narrow your perception and drop into that space of mind from which you can command volcanoes. A fulcrum, deep and strong, has been rooted in the earth nearby. You follow it to the midpoint of its potential torus, the center of the circle, like a hawk sighting prey. Right side of the road, 20 feet into the stone forest, out of line of sight amid the winds and drooping greenery. Yika! She appears at once from wherever she was sitting amid the tents.
Yeah, felt it.
Not active yet. By this you mean that the torus hasn't begun to draw heat or movement from the ambient. But that fulcrum is deep as a taproot. There's not much seismic potential gathered in this region, and indeed, much of the pressure on the lower level strata has been absorbed by the creation of the stone forest. Still, there's always heat if you go deep enough, and this is deep, solid, fulcrum precise.
We don't have to fight,
Yika yells, suddenly, into the forest. You start, though you shouldn't. You're shocked that she was serious, though you really should know better by now. She stalks forward, body taut, knees bent, as if she's about to sprint into the forest, hands held out before her and fingertips wiggling. It's easier now to reach for magic, though you still focus on the stump of your own arm to begin, out of habit. It will never feel natural for you to use this instead of orogeny. But at least your perception shifts quickly. Yika's way ahead of you. Wavelets and arcs of silver dance along the ground around her, mostly in front of her, spreading and flickering as she draws them up from the ground and makes them hers. What little vegetation you can sense in the stone forest makes it easier. The seedling vines and light-starved mosses act like wires, channeling and aligning the silver into patterns that make sense. Are predictable, are searching. Ah. You tense in the same moment that Yika does. Yes, there. Above that deep-rooted fulcrum, at the center of a torus that has not yet begun to spin, crouches a body etched out in silver. For the first time in comparison, You notice that in Origins, silver is both brighter and less complex than that of the plants and insects around it. The same, amount, if that word applies, if not capacity, or potential or aliveness, but not the same design.